Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Celeste.
Good morning, Cecil.
And you are listening to KBOO FM. This is More Talk Radio. And today is Monday, December 13th, 2010.
Is this the Ides of December? Because you know it's not always the 15th.
It's not always the 15th.
It might be. I know we had this discussion, I almost think, a year ago. Because we were coming to the end of the year. At any rate, we're hoping in some ways to make this a auspicious beginning. This will be our last program for 3 weeks. We're taking some time off to regroup, put some things together for the show. And so we hope you really enjoy this program and that it stimulates you to think new ways about discussion, democracy, leadership, and genius.
Joining us this morning is Professor James T. Kloppenburg, who is the author of Reading Obama, Dreams, Hope, and the American Political Tradition. He is the Charles Warren Professor of American History and Chair of the History Department at Harvard University. And we want to invite your phone calls a little bit later on in our program and respond to several questions. But one thing you might want to respond to is what do you believe are the central values that President Obama portrays, and what are his central beliefs, and whether or not you believe he is remaining true to his principles as he conducts the affairs of state. Thank you very much for joining us, Dr. Kloppenburg.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
I think it's somewhat fortuitous that we speak with you this morning. This past week, the president and the Congress came up with a tax deal, and the president went before the press and gave, I think, somewhat of a lecture demonstrating his philosophy of government and his political philosophy. And I thought it might be interesting to begin our conversation this morning if you would reflect upon, perhaps if you were able to listen to the president this past week, and whether or not his remarks revealed something about his political philosophy and his views of democracy.
Yes, I was very happy to hear his remarks, especially at the close of the press conference, because I think he was right that the debate over the tax bill is very much a replay of the debate over the health care legislation. And as he pointed out, his own goals, what he called the North Star, remain pretty much what they were at the beginning. But he's operating in a situation in which he's constrained by people who don't agree with him, and the challenge is to get the best deal that one can get when dealing with people who do not share your own principles. So when he talked about the lines in the sand that had remained where they were before, I thought he was exactly right. But he's dealing with a situation in which he doesn't have a chance to dictate to those who disagree with him what they must do. They have a say also in policy.
I think it's important for us to recall, I think you did a tremendous job in this book, Reading Obama, in terms of outlining the philosophical and political tradition that informs the president. But I think you also perform a very good service in reminding us to look back at Mr. Obama's writing, his two most popular books, but also his term as editor at the Harvard Law Review, and reflecting about who the man is. I think many of us, many American people during the 2008 election created Obama in our own image. And I think your book reveals that he was quite honest about who he was prior to the election. Why do you think many people had such a differing views of Mr. Obama?
It's a very good question. I think it is true that people did project on him their own conception of what the first black man elected president must do or what he must think. And in fact, I have to concede that during the primaries, I was not as enthusiastic about Barack Obama as a candidate because he seemed to me, since I'm fairly far on the left, to be very much a moderate in the mold of Bill Clinton, and I was looking for someone a little bit more progressive than that. But after I read the books, I realized that his sense of American politics is very much the sense of an early 20th century progressive who is looking for the common good and looking to do what can be done to help middle class and working class people. But he's also very much a realist and is aware that we inhabit a deeply divided culture and that there are people who feel just as passionately about a very different set of ideas. In that press conference, he referred to the idea of extending the Bush tax cuts as the Republican Party's holy grail. And I think that's not a bad statement of it. The notion that has come to us ever since Ronald Reagan that cutting taxes is always a good idea and limiting the reach of government is always the right thing to do is a deeply entrenched belief now. And those of us who don't share that view have to deal with those who have an entirely different way of looking at government. So I think people on the left were assuming that this man must be the embodiment of all of our hopes, when in fact in his books he had made clear just how careful a thinker he is and how much of a moderate he is, how much he is committed to democracy as a process of deliberation. And I think when he, in the press conference, talked about keeping his eye on the long battle, I think he was exactly right. If he is able to get reelected, he'll have 8 years to change the conversation in American politics. And I think over that long period of time, that's what he hopes to do.
Professor, when you have discussed the way Obama looks at group dynamics, you say that in his view and his perspective of democracy, he embraces the idea of conflict and discussion and critical analysis, critical thinking. And that these are crucial to real democracy. Yet a lot of people seem unable to accept this particular aspect of his philosophy and act as though discussion, breakdown, storming, norming, all of that are foreign or weak or ineffective aspects of discussion and true democracy. Can you talk a little bit about how this has been both his strength and his weakness?
That's a very good point. That's a good way to characterize it. I think intellectually it's clearly his strength because it grows from a really sophisticated understanding of how America came into being. When he writes about the Constitutional Convention and about the process of ratifying the Constitution in his book, The Audacity of Hope, he points out that James Madison, who's often considered to be the father of the Constitution, a man who played as large a role as anyone else in getting the Constitution through the Philadelphia Convention and then ratified, didn't get the Constitution he wanted. And in fact, Madison, looking back, said that nobody got the Constitution he wanted, that all of those who came to that convention had different ideas, and all of them were forced to give up their own pet conceptions of what would happen in order to find something that could be agreed upon. And so Obama understands that the nation is actually born through this process of give and take and compromise, and there's nothing un-American about it. That's just the way democracy works. So I think it's unfortunate that we inhabit a time when, thanks to outlets such as Fox News, we have people whose livelihoods depend on continuing to beat a drum that treats compromise as somehow anti-American or un-American, when in fact the opposite is true. And so I think what Obama is trying to do is to make clear how deep this tradition of compromise is in American history and to remind Americans that our current hyper-partisan atmosphere has not always been the American way.
We're speaking this morning with Dr. James T. Kloppenberg, the author of Reading Obama, Dreams, Hope, and the American Political Tradition. Before we go to our callers, I would like for you to continue on that last point in terms of the how we resolve conflict within the American society. Certainly, the hyper-conflicted era we live in is painful to many, but it's certainly not unique in American history.
Yes.
Could you compare it to another time and perhaps another political figure that maybe Mr. Obama might model himself after?
That's a good question. These comparisons are always difficult because individuals operate always in their own particular context, and so it's not so easy to hear echoes of the past in the present. But having issued that caveat, let me say that I think one illustration would be the approach of Thomas Jefferson, who comes into the presidency after a decade of really vicious partisan attacks and announces in his inaugural, "We are all Republicans, we are all Federalists," trying to end that partisanship, trying to turn down the volume somewhat. And at the very end of Abraham Lincoln's presidency, in his second inaugural address, when it looked as though the Union was certain to win the Civil War, he refused to crow in the way that a triumphant president might be expected to do, and instead insisted that both the North and the South had to take the blame for the tragedy of slavery that had caused the war, and that going forward it would not make sense to try to aim for retribution, but instead reconciliation. If one looks in the 20th century, one finds in a president such as Woodrow Wilson the willingness to do the kinds of legislative deal-making that Obama has been doing in order to get really substantial progress on the domestic front before the outbreak of Reform America's entry into the First World War. That's when the graduated income tax is put in place. That's when the idea of government regulation of the economy is really consolidated at the national level. And I think those are achievements that would not have been possible had Wilson not been willing to work with people across the aisle. Franklin Roosevelt is best remembered these days, at least by people on the left, as someone who spoke in very strident terms in the 1936 campaign about those who opposed him. But for most of his terms in the White House, Roosevelt was a master at not only keeping his base, what we would call his base, happy, but also trying to find support. And sometimes that meant finding support within his own party, because it was a very divided party ideologically. So I think there have been a number of presidents who have been aware that partisanship can be useful, but it can also be debilitating, and that if it's possible to generate more bipartisan support of particular policies, you can sometimes get things done that you couldn't get done otherwise. And I think this tax bill, flawed as it is, unpalatable as it is to many of us who were very much hoping for a more steeply graduated income tax and the end of the Bush-era tax cuts for the wealthiest Americans, unpalatable as that is, I think it may well be the best that Obama could have gotten at this point.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 here in the metro area, 91.9 in the Columbia River Gorge, 100.7 in the Willamette River Valley, and on web, it's KBOO.FM. This is More Talk Radio with Cecil Prescott, myself, Celeste Carey, and we are speaking with Dr. and also Professor James T. Kloppenburg, who is the author of Reading Obama, Dreams, Hope, and the American Political Tradition. We do invite your phone calls. The phone number is 503-231-8187. And we'll go to our first caller. Good morning, Stevie Ray.
Hey, guys.
How are you?
Well, first off, I expect to see you guys back after the holidays, right?
Oh, yes. Yes.
All right.
Like I said, we will be back.
Now, I was digging around in some archives, and I heard this Civil Liberties Constitutional Investigator reviewing Thurgood Marshall and how Obama's capacity to really do his homework. Thurgood Marshall had to recuse himself of several Supreme Court judgments because of the previous workings in his voting record and whatnot, and when he became a Supreme Court justice. And it started to make me think of Obama's choices for Supreme Court justice. What are we seeing these new justices have to participate in, recusing themselves? And so with a limping Supreme Court, we get from Obama no net neutrality, no Van Jones green jobs, no card check for our unions, but we do get executive powers. So is it just my aversion to the nature of celebrity, or is Obama like evil smart? I'd like you to have your guests maybe respond to that. Thanks.
Thank you for the question.
Well, it's a challenging question and a difficult one to answer this early into Sonia Sotomayor's and Elena Kagan's terms. Again, I think in naming them, he was trying to make a judgment based on the people he thought that the United States Senate would confirm rather than the people he might most have wanted to appoint. I think those are both excellent appointments. I think they will be proven to be excellent appointments in time. Elena Kagan is known as a very careful politic person, and I think we saw that in the hearings, and I think we're probably going to see that in her the record she compiles as a member of the Supreme Court. But I think it's very early for us to say that these are people who were chosen precisely because they would not take strong stands. It will take time before progressive justices are in the majority, and I think that's one of the most important reasons for the re-election of Barack Obama. But I, as many people do, share your impatience with the use of some of the techniques that were used by the Bush presidency. And I think part of what we're seeing now is an attempt to come to terms with the challenges that we have in a new age in which forms of electronic communication that really don't have much of a track record are now available both to people who want to destabilize government and to the government itself. Mm-hmm. And so it makes many of us uneasy, but I don't think yet that we're quite clear on where the Supreme Court is going to go on those questions. If indeed Sotomayor and Kagan become part of a majority rather than simply part of a dissenting minority.
I think it might be helpful for our listeners, most of whom have not read your book, if you were able to share with us something about the president's philosophical tradition, the political and thinkers who have influenced him, and set him up, allow us to see who he is.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate that. And it does actually lie behind the response I gave to your first caller. President Obama, I think, is the inheritor of a tradition of thinking about politics and about philosophy that originates with the American philosophical pragmatists of the late 19th and early 20th century, people such as William James and John Dewey. And those philosophers also influenced a generation of legal activists and scholars and judges, including people such as Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr. and Louis Brandeis and some of the justices who were part of the Supreme Court during FDR's years. And all of those thinkers shared an aversion to the idea that in questions of politics there can be absolute truths. They were committed instead to the idea that we have to be uncertain about what the best solution will be to a problem, not necessarily uncertain about our political convictions in the way that Obama indicated last week that he hasn't become unsure of his commitment to the ideals of equality and democracy, but unsure about how those translate into particular political programs or particular outcomes in court cases. And I think that tradition of judicial thinking, which is usually called either legal pragmatism or legal realism, is the tradition that Obama encountered when he was a student at the Harvard Law School, and that is quite clear from the teaching he did in the 10 years that he taught at the University of Chicago Law School. He really wanted his students to see all sides of every legal question that they were investigating, and to understand not just the legal precedents, but also to understand the social theory beneath particular ways of looking at the law. And that treatment of the law as an experiment, or to use his own image, as a conversation in which we participate, is very different from the perspective that many conservatives have now, that there is a unitary and unchanging original meaning of the Constitution. Constitution, and that all judges have to do is to find that original meaning and then apply it. Obama and those he studied with have a very different approach to the Constitution, one that I think historians consider more solidly grounded in the historical record, that the Constitution emerges from a process of compromise and that it was deliberately left open to amendment because the founders understood that history would proceed, cultures would change, and it would be necessary for the Constitution to be adapted to changing times.
If the Constitution is a living document, and to kind of reduce it just for the sake of this question, an open-ended question about governance and domestic stability, it kind of calls into question Obama's style of leadership. You wonder, is he more of a facilitator than maybe an overt leader?
Well, that too is a very good question, and I think it's difficult to give a straightforward answer to it because I think he's doing some of both. He's leading in a particular way. Mm-hmm. He's leading in the way that a person who is committed to this kind of open-ended understanding of the Constitution, this kind of deliberative democracy, would lead. And that's not the style of leadership that people who want someone to be pounding the table would prefer. But those of us who think that democracy really is about the give and take of deliberation much prefer this approach. And I think instead of feeding the hyper-partisanship of much of the news media, he's working to combat that. And I think the style of leadership that he has embodied so far has been part of a campaign to lower the temperature in American political debate. He was very explicit about that in his books, and I think he's been fairly successful in it in most of his public presentations. He hasn't engaged in the kind of demonizing of the opposition that we have seen in recent years, and I think he's trying to encourage those who would demonize him just to calm down and to realize that we're all in this as American citizens. We don't really help the process by engaging in the kind of name-calling that has become so common in public debate. If we realize, as he put in the press conference last week, that we disagree about many fundamental questions, the issue is, what can we do about that? And finding the common ground is the challenge. And as far as he's concerned, that's what a leader is supposed to do, is to help find that common ground. That was true of him when he was working in the community organizing network in Chicago before he went to law school. It was true of him in law school, and it was true of him afterwards. So I think it's very much the kind of leader he has always been, and I would predict the kind of leader he's likely to continue to be.
Well, that seems then that we have a conundrum here. We have a man who you describe as being a very deep and penetrating thinker, who is a pragmatist in that he is looking for a solution that will work, which calls then into existence the need for reasoned discussion. It's all right to be impassioned, but reasoned discussion. And yet nowadays we live in the age of short takes, short sound bites, polarized thinking, the inability to really analyze. And so it seems as though he, while being, as you've described him, a transformative leader at a transformative point in our society, is dealing with a governing body that doesn't seem capable of using the tools that will help us transform society.
Well, I think beneath the surface, there is actually a lot going on that is more consistent with his approach than with the Fox News approach.
Okay.
I think that the chances he has to address the public give him the opportunity to embody this approach to politics. And I think when we see the State of the Union address in a month or so, we'll have another opportunity to watch that. I mean, it's not as though in his last State of the Union address he was shying away from controversy. You'll recall that was a moment at which he called out the members of the Supreme Court. And I think he's done that, again, in a sort of reasoned way around a particular argument, not just generally trying to demonize those who disagree with him. But if you look at the legislative achievements of the first 2 years, those would not have been possible, I think, if he hadn't been able to persuade enough members of his own party to give up what he characterized in the press conference last week week as the purest sensibility, and to realize that if you're going to get anything, you have to take what the other side is willing to agree to. So I think that the most of the attention goes to the most the people who shout the loudest, or the people who are willing to make the most outrageous statements. And as a result, we tend to assume that that's where the action is. But I think all the opinion polls indicate that most of the American people actually cluster, something like 65%, cluster toward positions more toward the middle, even on the most hot-button issues, and that it's only the people on the far right and the far left who are activists, in fact, who do care passionately about these issues, who disagree with the more moderate positions. And so I think by appealing to that moderate middle and trying very hard to shift it to the left, to shift the center of debate to the left, Obama is actually accomplishing more than he would accomplish if he were to give the grandstand speeches that would make me and perhaps you happier, but would actually get less done than the strategy he's adopted.
We're speaking this morning with James Kloppenberg, author of Reading Obama. Our numbers here are 503-231-8187. Let's go to our next caller. Mark, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for a great discussion. A 95-year-old historian, Grace Boggs, described Obama as being filled with the Aloha spirit, which is, I think, a very nice, a very, you know, positive kind of perspective. I don't understand why President Obama hasn't sent Geithner and Bernanke back to the golf course, and I don't understand why he hasn't listened to that part of Harvard, the John Kenneth Galbraith side, which is critical of the financial markets. I think people are dispirited. I think they feel hopeless and excluded from our system because of the financial markets and the double standards that seem to operate. The final point I wanted to make was that President Obama was 11 years old when the Vietnam War ended. I'm wondering if you can comment on that and whether he really needs to, a certain leftist education on foreign policy and America's overreach.
Okay, two issues. The advice he's been getting from his team of economic advisors and the question of war. Many of us were puzzled with the appointment of both Geithner and Larry Summers to prominent positions in the Obama White House. And the explanation that I find the most compelling is one that focuses on the situation that he inherited after the election. I think when he became aware just how serious the economic downturn was and how close we were to falling off the cliff into a global, not just recession, but depression, I think that it was important, or at least this is what I've been told, and I find the argument convincing, he thought it was important to reassure the financial markets, because if we had gone from bad to a terrible depression, that consequence for ordinary Americans would have been far worse than what we've had instead. So as unpalatable as it is for many of us to see so many of the people with the greatest wealth and power in America untouched by the reforms that the Obama administration has put in place, I think they've been moving very cautiously precisely because their primary goal at this point is to get the economy rolling again, and satisfying as it would have been to many of us to see the people who were responsible for this taken to task, I think the judgment was that that would actually have caused more chaos and would have hurt more people than the less dramatic steps they took. So I'm with you. I wish there had been something more, but I think that was the judgment call. Now, as far as, and we'll see whether in the second 2 years, I mean, Larry Summers is leaving, Rahm Emanuel is leaving. We'll see whether there's some new people brought in, whether Robert Reich can find a home in the Obama administration. I'm not sure, but I think if you read Obama's own diagnosis of the problem of increasing inequality in America in The Audacity of Hope, he shares the view that this is a very serious problem for America, and I believe that that is a genuine conviction of his. The question is, how do you address it effectively? And I hope during the next 6 years we'll see him do that. Now, on the question of war, I think he saw his having missed Vietnam as giving him an opportunity not to be tarred by the brush that the Republicans used on John Kerry and on anyone who had the temerity to oppose the Vietnam War, as so many of us did. Again, I think that if you read Obama's account of the travesty of democracy that led to the Iraq invasion in The Audacity of Hope, you'll see that he shares your view that there was something seriously, deeply, profoundly mistaken about that decision. The question now is, what do we do there, and what do we do in Afghanistan? He concedes that we went into Afghanistan for different reasons from the reasons that we had for going into Iraq, better reasons because of 9/11. But now that we're there, and now that the war has extended for almost a decade, the question is, what do you do? And when he gave the speech at West Point announcing both the surge and the commitment to reevaluating the situation in the summer of 2011, I think he was operating very much as a philosophical pragmatist, suggesting that we were going to conduct the experiment that the military advisors told him we needed to conduct of increasing the number of troops on the ground, but that this was not an open-ended commitment based on the dogmatic view that we must win that war at all costs. If we find that we cannot win that war, and many of us think that's what the evidence does suggest, then we're going to reassess and decide what the next step should be. So again, I share your misgivings. I know many of us on the left feel exactly the same way as you do on both the financial and military fronts, but we're only 2 years in, and I think we could see something quite different in the next 2 years, and certainly something quite different in the second term. That is, if Obama is able to stick to the principles that he has articulated himself in his books, and I think they are the principles that he still holds.
Thanks very much. I hope we can find our way to a radical change that's really committed to job creation and punishing those who abuse the system, to shriveling the financial markets and living more simply. And thanks very much for your thoughtful answer.
Thank you for your call. And we'll go to our next caller. Good morning.
Good morning, John.
I tuned in late, so you may have covered some of this material already. And with all due respect, sir, I think we're all sounding like a bunch of oftentimes apologists for Professor Pragmatist Obama. And I supported him. I vote mostly Democrat because that's all we have. Come on, let's be honest. This is the whole system is rigged, two-party. And I think it's time to call Mr. Professor Obama on the carpet on using the bully pulpit of the presidency. He would get... Anytime he wants to do a speech, he would get on TV. They would, Fox and all the rest of those corporate scum would give him airing. And he could use a chalkboard and show the American people simple things like, hey, if I give huge tax cuts to the rich, extend the Bush tax cuts, that it's going to add $800 billion or whatever right to the debt. It's time for him to stand up and be a true progressive. And this is a top-down system as far as I'm concerned, and the top has way too much wealth, obviously. The statistics are there. He could show the American people that using the bully pulpit. I agree with people like Paul Krugman, more progressive economists, that are saying this guy is I think he's a laydown to the upper classes, to the right wing that run the show. And it's very sad, and I think it's if he wants to be reelected, he's going to have to start being a leader and start listening to some of FDR's speeches and looking at the presidents that are true progressives instead of just being a facilitator. We didn't elect him to do that, and he's a wonderful politician. There's no doubt about that. He's a brilliant man, but he's a laydown.
I think
it reminds me of the Quislings in Norway when the Nazis were incrementally taking over, who kept facilitating their takeover. And thank you very much, and I'll take your comments off air. Bye-bye.
Okay, thank you, Mike. And certainly these aren't comments that you have not heard before.
No, certainly most of my friends on the left share them. And so I think I'm not surprised to hear them, and indeed they were some of the questions I asked myself before I began work on this project and began reading what Obama had written. And I think actually that's what I would recommend to the last caller, that he pick up a copy of The Audacity of Hope and read it and see if he has the same sense of who this man is, because I think it will change his attitude toward President Obama. He mentioned Paul Krugman, whom many of us read fairly regularly, and on most issues I find myself more in agreement with Paul Krugman than I do with Larry Summers, but I must admit that when Larry Summers announced he was leaving the Obama administration to return to teaching, I was taken aback by one of the observations he made, which I think many of us who read Paul Krugman regularly would find equally interesting, and that was that when the Obama team was first in place, their first thought was to have a stimulus package more than twice the size of the one they got. Mm. And that's what Paul Krugman has been telling us twice a week now for months. The problem was that even within the Democratic caucus, there was no support for stimulus of that size. So not only was that not going to get through the Republican opposition, it was not going to get through the Democratic Congress. Given that reality, the stimulus that the Obama administration got through, again, looks like the best they could have done. And many of us are unhappy with the tax package for some of the same reasons that the last caller suggested. But again, if one looks not just at what would make us happy, but what could be done with the people who are actually in this Congress, the people who actually make these decisions, this is a bargain that many people on the right are now finding very unattractive, because it's